Good evening and welcome. I'm Marla Price. I'm director of The Modern, and I'm delighted to see you all here. It's a great pleasure to have Andrew Solomon here with us tonight. Andrew is a distinguished author and commentator on a wide range of subjects, a lecturer on psychiatry at Cornell University, and a special advisor to the Department of Psychiatry at Yale University. He's based in New York and London, if I'm not mistaken. I first met Andrew in 1988 when, in Moscow, we were both part of the throng in the Soviet Union at the time, trying to figure out if Gorbachev and Glasnost were real, and if they were, what was it all about? It was a very exciting, heady, confusing time. I was doing an exhibition that came to be called 10 plus 10, with Intercultura here in Fort Worth, which sadly no longer exists. And Andrew was writing his first book, The Irony Tower, Soviet Artists in a Time of Glasnost. I was telling Andrew earlier, I dipped into it this afternoon. I hadn't looked at it in many years, and I had my own little trip down memory lane. It just brought back all of the feelings and smells and sights of that time, which he captured brilliantly. In 2001, Andrew published The Noonday Demon, An Atlas of Depression, taking his beginnings from his own struggles with the disease. The book won countless awards. It was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, and it won the National Book Award. It is now considered essential reading on the subject and has been translated into 22 languages and still in print. He's here tonight to talk about his most recent book, which is called Far From the Tree, Parents and the Search for Identity. Selected as the New York Times Book of the Year for 2012, and just this weekend, it won the National Book Critics Circle Award. This book could also perhaps be subtitled Parenting as You Least Expect It. The parents and children in the book's 12 chapters face enormous range of challenges, physical, psychological. He discusses children conceived in rape, transgender children, and children who commit serious crimes. The book was published just about a month before the terrible shootings in Newtown, Connecticut, and so much attention has been given to Andrew's chapter on crime, including an unforgettable portrait of the Klebolds, parents of Dylan Klebold, who was one of the shooters at Columbine. But each of the 12 chapters of this book will inform you, it will enlighten you, and it will bring you powerful new perspectives on topics that you thought you knew a lot about. So we're very fortunate to have him here. Please welcome Andrew Solomon.
Well, many thanks to Marla for that extremely generous... Sorry, my microphone there. There we go. Many thanks to Marla for that extremely generous introduction, and many thanks to all of you for coming out on this crisp March evening. I'm going to talk to you about my book and its origins and its content, but I'm going to start by showing you a video in which you'll get to see a few of the people who are in the book so that you'll have a sense of what they look like before we begin. So, video now.
When I was born deaf, my mother cried. She really did not see a future.
The doctor said he would never amount to anything, his mental capacity would be little to none, and you should probably give him up and think about adoption.
I really didn't even know that something was going on, that there was something wrong in my mind.
I didn't know the word transsexual, the word transgender hadn't even been invented yet.
He has a mentor that helps him.
No biting, Chris.
Chris probably had one of the worst diagnoses ever. Self-injurious, swollen intestines, poisons in his system, mental retardation, severe autism. And I was pretty much told to put him in an institution.
When I was born, my mom refused to see me for 3 days. She was scared.
Before I transitioned, I just wasn't all there. I couldn't quite share my feelings. I couldn't quite be a full member of the family.
You sort of get what you get, and you go from there. And
you know, it's your choice. You want to make the best of it? You make the best of it. You want to make the worst of it? Throw yourself a pity party.
I set out to write a book which was about how people found meaning in difficulty. It's hard for the kids to accept themselves. It's hard for their families to accept them. It's hard for the larger society to accept the kids and their parents. All of it is a struggle. I wouldn't ever want to pretend that these aren't difficult lives. They are very difficult lives. They're full of pain and complexity.
We have joints and bones that are twisted and distorted. So our life is marred with a lot of surgeries. Myself, I've had 30.
And there was one guy that I had a crush on. He said to me, "Why do you lisp?" And my heart would crush.
Chris did not communicate. He didn't sit down. He didn't put on clothes. He wouldn't go outside. He ate the walls. He ate the table. He ate the rug.
I could feel the back of my neck, you know, popping and sizzling, like my head was just heating up.
We couldn't eat in the home. We couldn't have lights on. We couldn't have the TV on. If I coughed, he would run downstairs and punch me.
I actually felt that I was a surgeon, and I felt I had to literally extricate the demon from inside of my body.
When I started this book, I knew that I was going to be looking at a lot of desperate situations.
And I would do that by cutting and burning myself.
What I didn't know was how much joy I was going to find.
When I was born, my dad said, "He looks cute. He's just got a big head and little arms." The funny thing is, I still look that way.
And the relief that came over my face when I heard that there was a name to what was going on with me.
I used what God gave me. God didn't give me, you know, legs to run. He didn't give me arms to play football with. He gave me a brain, and he gave me a heart, and I try to use both of those things to the fullest.
The thing I've learned most over the years is to be a parent first. I thought to myself, if he's happy, if he stops hurting himself, you know, if I could hug him, that would be the greatest gift in life.
It's kind of pretty sure that I'm going to have obstacles, but I would have had them anyway.
I know my dad was very, very proud of me because I went on a journey that he never dreamed possible.
I don't think of myself as a schizophrenic. I am Susan.
There really isn't any definition of what's normal or not normal or far from the tree or right under the tree.
I'm lucky to have had her in this particular period of time.
I'm lucky too.
Thank you.
The love that parents have for their children.
I guess we are pretty lucky, huh?
Yes, Mom. Yeah.
Can see them through an enormous amount.
So that video will have given you a sense of some of the people I interviewed as I was writing my book. It was a long 11-year process interviewing and meeting people. And I really started off on that journey myself when I was assigned by the New York Times to write about the deaf. I was assigned that more than 20 years ago now, and I thought it was a curious assignment because I had mostly been doing foreign reporting. And my editor said to me, "This is a foreign world within our own society, and I thought you might be able to get inside of it." And I, at the time, thought of deafness as nothing but a deficit. I thought those poor people who can't hear, what a tragedy for them not to be able to function in the world the way that everyone else does. And then I went off and I began meeting deaf people, and I got drawn into the world of the deaf culture, and I found that there were deaf clubs. I found that there was deaf theater. I went and saw recitations of deaf poetry. I went to the Miss Deaf America contest, which was quite something, at which somebody was complaining about somebody else's bad slurry signing. I went to of things, and I came to realize that while it's not my culture, and I don't particularly want to join it, it is a culture, and it's as valid as many other cultures I belong to and many others that I respect, that these people who couldn't hear didn't just have a deficit of hearing, they had the presence of membership in this rich culture. And as I continued my research, I learned that most deaf people are born to hearing parents, and that what they ordinarily experience is having parents who think that deafness is a deficit, who try to get their kids to function as much as possible in the hearing world, and that many of those kids then discover the deaf culture when they hit adolescence. And when I wrote about this 20 years ago, I said that the process felt familiar to me because it reminded me of my own experience and the experience of other gay people I knew who had grown up in a family that really wanted them to conform in some way to what they perceived to be ordinary and normal, and who were not necessarily prepared for having a child who would have membership of one kind or another in a culture that was foreign to them. And I was very engaged by that parallel, and I wrote about it at the time. As I was writing about the deaf, it was just at the time that the cochlear implant was becoming more widely available and more effective. It's a device that's surgically implanted optimally in children, and it provides some facsimile of hearing. It bypasses the cochlea, which is the part of the ear that tends to be damaged in most, though not all, deaf people. And while doctors were hailing this and many patients as an incredible, marvelous breakthrough, there were also members of the deaf community who were railing against it and who said that it represented a kidnapping of their next generation and a destruction of their culture. And so I was interested in this cultural model, the cultural model of deafness, the cultural model of gayness, which I felt also, should such a surgery come along, could vanish in an instant. And I thought, what does this mean? And then a friend of a friend of mine had a daughter who was a dwarf. And I learned that most dwarfs are born to parents of average height. And this woman said to me, I haven't decided what to do. Perhaps I should bring my daughter up just like everyone else and tell her she's only a little bit short. Or perhaps I should actually try to introduce her into a dwarf culture and join the little people of America. And as I listened to her narrate her anxiety and her bewilderment about this, I thought, here it is again, a family that perceives itself to be at some level normal with a child who represents some kind of startling abnormality. And I was engaged by the idea that if that had happened in these three areas, for gay people, for deaf people, and for dwarfs, it must be happening for an awful lot of other people. And from that, I hatched the idea that there's such a thing as horizontal identity and vertical identity. Vertical identity, in my parlance, is any identity that's handed down generationally. So one's ethnicity is, in general, a vertical identity. One's nationality usually is. One's religion often is. There are these many things which may present problems for you, but which you have in common with your parents. And those things, parents tend to reinforce a sense of pride and engagement with from the very beginning. So you could argue that it's quite difficult in American society as it's currently constructed to be a member of a racial minority, but nobody is trying to ensure that all the children born to members of racial minorities come out as blondes. It's not an area of research. But these other identities, which I called horizontal identities, identities you don't have in common with your parents and that you have to learn from a peer group, those identities people have constantly sought to cure, to treat, to resolve, to cause to go away. And I was very interested in how many of those identities there are and in how frequent this experience is of families who are dealing with children who are different from them. And I began the research, not sure which categories I would end up writing about, and I ended up with 10 of them. I wrote about deafness, dwarfism, Down syndrome, autism, schizophrenia, multiple severe disabilities. I wrote about prodigies whose families are also quite overwhelmed and ill-prepared often to give them an optimal education, about families bringing up children conceived in rape, about families of people who commit crimes, as Marla mentioned, and about families of people who are transgender. And I framed it all with my experience of my own childhood and how I had struggled with my own identity and the experience of becoming a father, as I eventually did. I believe that each of these differences taken individually can be quite isolating, and I gave some time and energy to looking at how lonely people were within each of these silos, the people who were dealing with deafness, the people who were dealing with dwarfism. These are not high conditions, though they are much more frequent than many of us realize. But what I came to think was that as long as you think, as a family, I only have something in common with other families dealing with what I'm dealing with. My child has autism, I have something in common with other families with autism. As long as you think that way, you're in a small and narrow and contained context. But if you begin to allow yourself to think that you have something in common with all of the families who are dealing with children who are alarming or different or dramatic in some way, then you realize that you're actually in a company that includes much of the world. And while I decided in this book to focus on these extreme circumstances, they're really just a window into a universal. The universal being that every parent deals with a child who presents some form of differences. I have yet to meet a mother or father who hasn't occasionally looked at their child and thought, "Where did you come from?" And so in the same way that we test out flame retardant pajamas in an inferno to make sure they won't catch fire when our child reaches across the stove, so by looking at these more extreme circumstances, I think we illuminate the experience of parenthood altogether. I said that I had begun the book with a discussion of my own childhood, as indeed I did. And I remembered, for some reason, particularly vividly, a day when I went with my mother and my brother to a shoe store when I was perhaps 6 years old. And as we were leaving the shoe store, the shoe salesman said that each of us could have a balloon and asked what color balloon everyone would like to have. And my brother said that he would like a red balloon. My brother said a red balloon. And I said a pink balloon. And my mother said, "I think you'd really rather have a blue balloon." And I said, "No, I really like the pink balloon." And she reminded me that blue was my favorite color after all. The fact that blue now is my favorite color, but I'm still gay, is, I think, evidence of my mother's influence and its limits. So off I went into these communities, and I want to read you a few passages, some of them from the people I met, but some of them also from journalism. This was written when I was 3 years old. It was published in Time magazine, that voice of the American mainstream, and not a particularly oppressive or conservative take on most things, but this is what they wrote. "Even in purely non-religious terms, homosexuality represents a misuse of the sexual faculty. It is a pathetic little second-rate substitute for reality, a pitiable flight from life. It deserves no encouragement, no glamorization, no rationalization, no fake status as minority martyrdom, no sophistry about simple differences in taste, and above all, no pretense that it is anything but a pernicious sickness." It's striking that that was something that was said in 1966, and that we now have a president who has just filed a brief in support of gay marriage with the Supreme Court. And whether people entirely agree with him or not, there is no question that our thinking on these subjects has evolved dramatically. And I thought to myself, how did we get from there to here? And what is the tension that's buried in that transition from that view of things to the current view of things? What is it that changed so much for people? And how is it that being gay, which I experienced in my childhood as an oppressive illness, came to be an identity for me? And how do people make the transition, the difficult transition from illness to identity? And I thought, okay, if the deaf, with their deaf culture, many of them experience deafness not as an illness but as an identity. And if I ended up experiencing my sexuality not as an illness but as an identity, and if some of the dwarfs I met had a sense of dwarf identity, I thought, then where else is this plank being tread between these two ways of being? And I ultimately decided that you can experience pretty much anything as an illness or as an identity, and that it's our limitation not always to be able to see both at the same time. And I also thought the categories are intensely fluid. So I don't know which things that we now think of as illnesses will seem like identities in 50 years. But I guarantee you, there are some of those things. And when I talk to people who are within these cultures, a lot of them were deeply offended and deeply pained by the attempts to cure and resolve them. So I was very interested in autism activism. I, of course, had thought of autism initially as something that was a grave misfortune and found that many people who are high-functioning enough to be able to express themselves, they're not the children banging their heads in a corner, but many people with autism actually feel that it's a different way of thinking. And there's a whole movement called neurodiversity, which is about validating autistic ways of thinking. This is what Jim Sinclair, who's an autistic person, wrote. He said, "When parents say, 'I wish my child did not have autism,' what they're really saying is, 'I wish the autistic child I have did not exist, and I had a different non-autistic child instead.' Read that again. This is what we hear when you mourn over our existence. This is what we hear when you pray for a cure. This is what we know when you tell us of your fondest hopes and dreams for us, that your greatest wish is that one day we will cease to be, and strangers you can love will move in behind our faces." It's a very arresting position and a very startling one, I think, this idea of having so much and so vivid an attachment to the condition that you have. I looked at these families who are dealing with children who are different, and I was very interested in the way in which they tended to value and to cherish their children. Children who in many instances represented conditions which were horrifying to them at the time that the child was diagnosed, and at how connected these parents came to feel to their children. Clinton Brown, who was the dwarf who you saw there, as he said in the introduction, he was born with these terrible deformities. His parents were actually told not to take him home from the hospital because he would never walk or talk and would never be able to relate to them. And I, at one point, was talking to his mother, who insisted on taking him home. She was a telephone operator. Her husband was a construction worker. They didn't have a lot of resources. It was before the days of the internet. She nonetheless somehow found her way to a doctor at Johns Hopkins, who was a leading figure for dealing with diastrophic dwarfism, which is an especially disabling condition which Clinton has. And I remember at one point calling up Cheryl, and she explained to me that Clinton, when he was a kid, had been in the hospital all the time for all of those surgeries and figured since there was nothing else much to do, he might as well do his schoolwork. And he was ultimately the first member of his family to go to college. And he went to college not very far away from where they lived, and he drove a specially fitted car because he's so tiny. And she saw it in the parking lot outside of a bar. And she said, "I had to stop myself from going in. I went home. I left 25 messages on his cell phone, and I said, 'You know, are you okay?' She said, 'I figured they're 6 feet tall, he's 3 feet tall, 2 beards for them is 4 beards for him.'" She said, "And then I thought to myself, if someone had told me when he was born that my worry would be that he'd go out drinking and driving with his college buddies, I'd have been so glad to have that problem." And I said to her, "How did it happen? How did someone who had such a poor prognosis end up being accomplished and charming? He has a lovely girlfriend who's also a dwarf, but quite beautiful." I said, "How did it all come to pass?" And this is what she said. "What did I do? I loved him, that's all. The other day, these people much higher up than us socially, much more educated, called me up and said they couldn't handle this. They were in politics and thought the stigma would be harmful to them, and they gave their baby up for adoption. That's just what they were going to do, and it's the opposite of what I was going to do right from the start. The other day, Clinton came home and he goes, 'Ma, I saw a blind man today with a stick in Manhattan. There were people rushing back and forth, and he was all alone. I just felt like crying. I felt so sorry for him. So I offered to bring him to where he needed to go.' Clinton just always had that light in him, and we were lucky enough to be the first to see it there." These attitudes, which seem very rational to us, have also developed enormously in the course of the last 50 years. This will be my last reading from a magazine from the 60s, but this is 1968 in the Atlantic Monthly. By an ethicist named Joseph Fletcher, and he said, "There is no reason to feel guilty about putting a Down syndrome baby away, whether it's put away in the sense of hidden in a sanatorium or in a more responsible, lethal sense. It is sad, yes, dreadful, but it carries no guilt. True guilt arises only from an offense against a person, and a Downs is not a person. I spent a lot of time with families of people with Down syndrome, and I was struck among those people by how much things have changed because mostly of better educational methodologies, though also some medical progress. People with Down syndrome used to have a life expectancy of 20. They now have a life expectancy of 70. People with Down syndrome used to be considered ineducable. Now many people with Down syndrome are fully literate, and there are people with Down syndrome who have got careers as actors. I was out with one person with Down syndrome who's an actress, and people came over to get her autograph, and I thought, she's more a celebrity than she is a disabled person in this context. She was someone who'd been on Glee. And as I looked at the way these changes had taken place, I was very struck by the vision it had taken for people confronted with Fletcher's attitude to insist that educational strategies be developed for their children. One of the families with whom I spent time, Tom and Karen Robards, had been very much involved in the movement to change the way people with DS are educated. They started when their son was born, looking for good educational opportunities. They couldn't find very much. They finally decided they had to start something to help him get a better education. They went to the Archdiocese because they were Catholics and active there and asked him for some space. Cardinal for some space. He gave them two large public lavatories, which they converted into classrooms, and they set up something called the Cook Center, which now educates thousands of children with Down syndrome and has helped to generate educational philosophies that have been transformative for people who have that condition. And I talked to them about it, and they talked with a sense of great zeal about what they'd done. And I said to them, did they wish actually that they'd had a different life? Were they sorry that their child had Down syndrome? Were they sorry that they'd had to deal with this all this time? And Tom said, well, for our son, I'm sorry because it's a difficult way to be in the world. And for David, if I could make it go away, I would want to. And his mother said, I'm with Tom. If I could cure David, I would, for David. But I think that we've grown so much as a result of having to deal with this. We've had so much purpose. I'd never have believed 23 years ago when he was born that I could come to such a point. But I have. For David, I'd cure it in an instant. But for us, I wouldn't exchange these experiences for anything. They've made us who we are. And who we are is so much better than who we would have been otherwise. I ran into this thing over and over again of the way in which the process of moving toward a cure and the process of moving toward social acceptance seemed almost to bang into each other. So you have a real feeling that for the deaf, the cochlear implant has come along at about the same time that wider acceptance of deafness as a culture has come along. For Down syndrome, the ability to educate people with Down syndrome has coincided rather dramatically with the moment when prenatal testing is getting easier and easier. There soon will be a blood test which can be done very non-invasively to check for Down syndrome quite early in a pregnancy, and more people choose to terminate those pregnancies. I don't have a sense of mission about how people need to keep the pregnancies, but I do about trying to make everyone alive to and aware of what the decisions are that they're making. I feel as though we are in a moment, it's a little bit like the end of an opera where the hero realizes he loves the heroine at the exact same time that she expires on a sofa. And we have a world which is becoming somewhat more accepting and a world full of cures. I have no objection to cures, and I think that they're incredibly valuable. I think often people don't know what's curable and what's not curable. So when I was a small child, I was diagnosed with dyslexia, and my mother worked incredibly closely with me day after day on reading and writing. And reading and writing turned out okay. But at the same time, I think there was then this feeling that everything could be changed and fixed, and the discomfort that my family had initially with my being gay was a difficult time for them and for me, though it all resolved well in the end. I think a lot of it comes down to that old serenity prayer. You need to change the things that are readily changeable, to accept the things that are unchangeable. That much is easy. And to know the difference, which is the very, very difficult part, and it's something that people consistently struggle with. I was very impressed when I talked to people who had children with multiple severe disabilities by how deeply attached parents could become to children who, in fact, unlike Clinton, didn't develop the ability to walk or to talk or to communicate, and who, to an outside eye, might seem quite inert. And I was always particularly moved by one family who had two children with very, very severe disabilities, whom they kept at home until finally the mother herniated a disc while she was trying to lift her sort of essentially limp and passive son out of a bathtub. And they finally put them into a group home where they visited them every day, but where there were staff and cables and pulleys that could be used to move those people around. And at one point, one of her sons was being given a bath, and the person who was giving him a bath went into another room to get something, and he slipped down and he drowned. And when his ashes were buried, his mother said, "Let me bury here the rage I feel to have been twice robbed, once of the child I wanted and once of the son I loved." And I was very struck by how much of that kind of love there was. And I was struck by how often people seem to have constructed meaning out of their experiences. The Robards with their educational system, these people with their severely disabled son, many others with children who were difficult or problematical in one way or another. And I wondered how far that kind of love and acceptance could extend. And so I went off and I interviewed people with many other kinds of disabilities and challenges. There was one parent, also of a severely disabled child, who said, "People always regale us with these little sayings like, 'God doesn't give you any more than you can handle.' But children like ours are not preordained as a gift. They're a gift because that's what we have chosen." And I thought a lot about that idea that meaning is constructed, that meaning is not inherently and automatically there, and the value of that construction and the difficulty that's involved in it seemed to me to be profound. Marla mentioned that I had interviewed the family of Dylan Klebold, who was one of the perpetrators of the Columbine massacre. I went off to meet them thinking, when I get to know these people, I'll understand what happened and I'll understand why it happened. And the more I got to know them, the more bewildered I became, the harder and harder it grew to understand how something like this could have come out of their household. They're kind, decent, generous, lovely people whom I could very happily have grown up with as my parents if mine had been unavailable. And I really came to feel very close to them. And they had dealt with such an incredible tragedy, and Dylan's mother, Sue, was determined not to separate herself from what had happened, but to look into it as deeply and as thoroughly as she could. At the end of the first weekend of interviews we did, and we recorded maybe 20 hours of interviews over the course of 3 days, which is a lot and was very draining, we were all sitting at the kitchen table, and Sue was just putting dinner together, and I said, "If Dylan were here now, do you have a sense of what you'd want to say to him or what you'd want to ask him?" And his father said, "I sure do. I'd want to ask him what the hell he thought he was doing." And his mother looked at the ground, and she thought for a minute. And then she lifted her head and said, "I would ask him to forgive me for being his mother and never knowing what was going on inside his head." A little while later, we were having dinner, and I thought over and over again about how strange it is that, you know, we used to think that people were gay because they had overbearing mothers and passive fathers. We used to think that people had autism because they had refrigerator mothers. We used to think that people had schizophrenia because their parents harbored an unconscious wish that they not exist. If you go back a couple of hundred years, people thought that deformity and dwarfism were caused by the unexpressed lascivious longings of the mother. There's been a lot of blaming the mother and blaming the family. We've given it up in all of those domains. And we haven't given it up in the field of crime. And people find it very difficult to believe believe that decent people produce criminal children. Now, it's true that terrible, abusive parents can push their children toward criminal behavior, and that sometimes very enlightened parents can help to steer their children toward more productive lives, but not always, and not always by any means. And this is what Sue said to me a few years later when we had dinner. When it first happened, I used to wish that I had never had children, that I had never married. If Tom and I hadn't crossed paths at Ohio State, Dylan wouldn't have existed, and this terrible thing wouldn't have happened. But over time, I've come to feel like, for myself, I am glad I had kids, and glad I had the kids I did, because the love for them, even at the price of this pain, has been the single greatest joy of my life. When I say that, I am speaking of my own pain and not of the pain of other people. But I accept my own pain. Life is full of suffering, and this is mine. I know it would have been better for the world if Dylan had never been born, but I believe it would not have been better for me. So, onward from there, the prodigies, many of these parents who had these bewildering children, and I saw that it's as difficult to have the mind of a 30-year-old in the body of a 5-year-old as it is to have the mind of a 5-year-old in the body of a 30-year-old. In either case, you're what's called asynchronous. You are out of keeping with the other people around you, and it's very hard to find peers. So you have little children who have extraordinary talents and gifts and are spending their time either with people who can appreciate those gifts but who aren't very interested in the emotional life of a 5-year-old, or with people who are also 5 years old but who have got not the slightest idea what the kid is talking about. And that can be a very tough call. I had an extraordinary experience with one mother who has a son who's a pianist. He was 7 at the time that we met. He was an incredibly gifted pianist, but he was leading a life in which he was making endless recordings and running around a great deal. And I wondered what his mother made of it and whether it was important to her that he have a normal childhood. And he said, "I have a normal childhood. Come on upstairs and I'll show you my room. It's kind of messy, but you can come anyway." So he went upstairs and I saw his room, and it was kind of messy, and he showed me his favorite cartoons, and he had a whole shelf of Sesame Street videos that I saw. And then he said, "Okay, let's go downstairs and I'll play you the Chopin Fantasy Impromptu." So downstairs we went, he played it with a kind of adult nuance and yearning that were inconceivable in someone who was still a big fan of Cookie Monster. And his mother looked at me when he finished playing and she said, "You see, he's not a normal child. Why should he have a normal childhood?" So it's a position one can argue with, but it was one that she argued for quite powerfully. I'm going to do my last little anecdotal section here about Kim Reed, who was the transgender woman you saw in the film. When she was still a boy named Paul, she was the quarterback on her high school football team. And she did a wonderful film called Prodigal Sons, in which she went back to her 20th reunion, her 20th high school reunion. My favorite moment in the film is when she's there and everyone is being very embracing, and this woman who was one of her classmates comes up to her and says, "But Kim, we've all changed." But the occasion when I went out to Montana to spend time with her family, her mother, by the way, had been a beauty queen from Fort Worth in her youth. But the time when I went out to Montana was when Kim had received a call from the pastor at the church in which she grew up, inviting her to have a special weekend in which she showed the film in Helena. And Kim said, "I don't live in Helena anymore. I live in New York. My mother lives in Helena." She said, "It's really up to my mother." And Carol, who was really very uncomfortable with all of this, nonetheless said, "I'd rather that it be shown at church with people I know coming to be part of it than that it just show up in a local movie house." And so she decided to go ahead with it. And in the end, the pastor invited Kim to show the film on Friday, to have a set of seminars in which she talked with people about all the issues it brought up on Saturday, and to give the sermon at church on Sunday. And she gave an unbelievably moving sermon in which she alluded to the fact that her film had included some of the high school football footage. And I'll read you part of that sermon. She said, The night before last, when our film was playing in here, I went outside to the columbarium where my father's ashes rest. As I was kneeling there by what I call Dad's spot, I thought of the hours and hours of videotape that he shot lovingly of me during my football games, and how much of the same footage was now being shown inside this sanctuary. Now, it's certainly not the context that any of us expected, but I knew Dad would be proud. And just then, the dusk breeze blew in this waft of sound, and it was strangely familiar to me, and I realized it was the crosstown football game coming from the stadium. The band was playing, and the announcer was bellowing, and all of these old tapes were playing inside here on the screen, and I knew that new ones were being recorded just a few blocks away. Those recording their new memories to tape should be only so lucky as to be surprised by the last thing that they expected from their loved ones, only so fortunate as to get a chance to welcome them home with radical love. I thought about how all these cycles of lives would continue on, and so many aspects of my life coalesced in that one moment, that one beautiful, stunning, blessed moment. The past and the present, parent and child, male and female, the pain that life sometimes brings, and the soothing love that welcomes it with open arms after its exhausting journey into a distant country. The Bible reading that day was the prodigal son, and Kim said that the prodigal son is always seen as a parable about the father and how the father welcomes this prodigal son back home. And Kim said, I think of it from the standpoint of the child and what it means to have done something unacceptable and to be welcomed back home nonetheless. That afternoon, I was out walking with Carol, with Kim's mom, and I said to her, Do you wish that Paul had just been happy to be Paul and had stayed that way? And she said, well, of course I do. It would have been easier for Paul and for the rest of us. But the key phrase in there is happy to be Paul. He wasn't, and I am just so glad that he had the courage to do something about it. I had somebody say this weekend, Carol, Paul died, and I haven't finished mourning that. I don't feel that. Kim is much more present to people than Paul ever was. Paul was never rude. He just wasn't totally present. We didn't quite have his attention. And look what we got. Kim. And I was very struck by that adoration. And I was struck by the adoration of all of these families, by the Robards, who would have loved to help their child, but who adored him and were grateful for the life he had given them. I was struck by the Klebolds and Sue Klebold's insistence that she wouldn't even want to imagine a life without her child. I was struck by the way that Clinton Brown's family looked at him with complete wonderment and thought that he had achieved and accomplished things he might not have achieved without all of those challenges in front of him. And I looked at how all of these people in all of these difficult lives had constructed so much meaning out of their experiences. And I thought, how did they manage to do it? Where did all of that meaning come from? And I thought about that idea that the meaning is something that one seeks for and that one finds there. And I thought, isn't it strange that these people say that they're glad they had the children they had? And then I thought, but we all do that. All of us have children who are in some way, all of us who have children, who are in some way or in some measure flawed, and we don't want to exchange them for better models. And if a sort of glorious angel came through my living room ceiling and said, we can take away your children and bring you others who are nicer and more attractive and funnier and snugglier and whatever else they could be, I would cling to the children I have and pray away that terrible spectacle. And I think that that's the feeling of all of these parents, that taking care of someone who is innocent and helpless is a very bonding experience. And once you've gone through it, you're bonded to that particular child and to the particularities of the life that child has given you. Not everyone. Half the children who are available for adoption in the U.S. have disabilities of some kind. But half the children available for adoption in the U.S. is still only a very small proportion of the children who are disabled in this country. I've been very lucky. When I was little, I worried that if I were gay, I wouldn't be able to have children. And in my adult life, I have had children. I have a daughter who lives here in Fort Worth and whose mother is one of the most beloved people of my whole life. And I have a son who lives with my husband and me in New York. The day after our son was born, we found out that he was not extending his legs correctly, and the pediatrician on call at the hospital where he was born said that he might have brain damage, and we had to go and have lots of testing. And I thought, well, here I am, I've written this whole book about how families respond to children with these unanticipated challenges and how much value people have found in these lives. And here I have this little newborn child whom I desperately want to protect from having something seriously wrong with him. I felt that I wanted to hold on to him and keep him from the tests. I wanted him to go through them and come out all right. In fact, it turned out he was completely fine. And by that afternoon, he was extending his legs perfectly satisfactorily. But I closed the book with this thought, with which I will also close this talk. Children ensnared me the moment I connected fatherhood with loss, but I am not sure I would have noticed that if I hadn't been immersed in this research. Encountering so much strange love, I fell into its bewitching patterns and saw how splendor can illuminate even the most abject vulnerabilities. I had witnessed and learned the terrifying joy of unbearable responsibility, recognized how it conquers everything else. Sometimes I had thought the heroic parents in this book were fools, enslaving themselves to a life's journey with their alien children, trying to breed identity out of misery. I was startled to learn that my research had built me a plank and that I was ready to join them on their ship. Thank you. Thank you. I'll be glad to take some questions if anyone has questions.
Anyone? Yes.
First of all, I wanted to thank you for coming to Fort Worth. Like you, I grew up in Indian walk shoes with balloons. So I enjoyed that part of your book, of course. I'm about to become a grandmother, and I'm constantly harangued by people wanting to know the sex of the child as though we all owe them this information, which is unknown to me and to my daughter. When I was reading your book, of course, I noticed the different categories of disabilities and identities, some which make some average people more uncomfortable than others, and of course the transgender one category is one that is likely to make people more uncomfortable than deafness. What I found very poignant was the passage in which you or one of your interviewees suggested that what does it matter? And I wondered whether you felt that someday on this planet we will go toward gender-neutral life. I know some Scandinavian countries are slightly going toward that, and I was thinking of the people you interviewed who may be feminine on female on top and masculine on the bottom, or, you know, the reverse, and whether, considering the progress that has been made in some ways, you think that someday will be a gender-neutral world, or whether you think that, as is happening in this country, a lot of politicians feel they have a right to tell us what can be done in our bedrooms.
Well, there are quite a few extremely interesting questions blended in there. I'll begin by saying that I have some counterphobic tendencies, which is to say that I run toward things that I find frightening so that I can get over being so frightened of them, and that a lot of this book involved going into contexts that made me very uncomfortable, not only going into the context of criminals, but also I was uncomfortable with people who were trans. I was uncomfortable in some ways with people who were disabled, and I thought exposure is the thing that will make me feel less uncomfortable, and spending time with people, and indeed that's what happened. And one of the things I'd hope the book accomplishes is to make people feel a little bit that way. And I've had a lot of letters from people who've said, I was just on a cruise and there was a family there of dwarfs and I looked at them very differently than I would have before I'd read your book. So that was very gratifying for me. But I think that the idea of the book entirely is to give people some exposure in a relatively safe way to things that make them uncomfortable. I think that the question of whether we're moving toward a gender-neutral world, I think it's impossible to know what we're moving toward until we've gotten there. I think we're moving toward a world, I hope, in which there is more leeway for people to express their gendered selves in a way that makes them comfortable, and in which there is less of a tendency to say, boys must be like this and girls must be like that. But I don't think that that necessarily constitutes a gender-neutral world. I mean, my two children are, my little girl is incredibly, she loves everything pink and girly and her dolls and taking care of babies, and all that my son wants to talk about is cars and trucks. And I think that there is a certain amount of that that's innate, because I don't think either of them have been pushed in those directions. And I think even many transgender people, I mean, there are some people who choose to occupy a middle range of the spectrum, who are what's called genderqueer and who aren't really identified as a particular gender. But someone like Kim, I mean, she's very feminine. She's very, if I may say so, ladylike. I don't think that she represents a move toward a gender-neutral world. I hope that the employment opportunities available to men and women will be relatively the same. And I hope we'll have a society in which there is a male equivalent to a tomboy, in which a boy who has a slightly girlish tendency is not teased and castigated endlessly on the playground, or indeed in adult life. So I think we need to have very broad tolerance, but I wouldn't want to see, and I don't think we will see, gender disappear. I think gender is deeply built into our DNA. At the back.
Yes, I just wonder, in terms of you as a writer overall, clearly you have a great deal of technical proficiency. Clearly, a lot of your work involves creating context and frames. And I just wonder if you are tempted to embark on literary fiction or some kind of hybrid form down the road after having gone through these different discrete narratives, which could have taken different, you know, types of turns depending on the perspective that you, as both protagonists, want to bring.
I did write a novel that was published in 1994, and it's being reissued in June. It's been out of print for a while, and there's a new edition of it coming out, in which I was finally able to correct two tiny flaws that have annoyed me all these many years. And I've been working from time to time on two fiction things. One is that I want to write a collection of children's stories based on some stories that I sometimes tell my children at night, and the other is a novel. So I'm interested in that form, but I feel like part of the experience of this book has been the discovery of community, and I will have to see whether I can write anything in fiction that seems to me to be, I don't want to describe my own work as groundbreaking because it sounds pompous, but I feel like in this book I managed to find people who had no voice and give them a voice, and I would be sad not to make continued use of that ability, such as it is. So I'll always, I think, go on doing this kind of nonfiction. When I started, you know, when I was 18, I wanted to be a novelist. And then people said to me, well, what ties your work together? My first book, as Marla mentioned, was about Soviet artists. The novel, which deals in part with a fictionalized description of my mother's illness and death, a book on depression, and now this book. And I said that I think the unifying theme is the way in which people find occasions for great dignity in circumstances of great difficulty. And I think that's what I'll continue to write about, whether in fiction or in nonfiction.
Yes. Of all the groups you dealt with, which do you feel was the hardest to identify with, and why?
Which group was the hardest to identify with? The most distressing chapters were the one on families bringing up children conceived in rape. And I was very aware of being a man interviewing women about a particular painful experience that, I mean, men do not become pregnant through rape. So it was a female experience, and I was very daunted by it. Schizophrenia, I think, is in many ways the most difficult of the diagnoses because it comes so late. So if you have a child who's autistic, as Jim Sinclair said at the beginning, that's who your child is. And if you are talking about your child without autism, you're imagining someone who has never existed and who never will exist. If you have a child with schizophrenia and you try to imagine that child without schizophrenia, you're imagining that child is who they were until the age of 17 or 18 or 22, because that's about the time that schizophrenia tends to set in. So I think that's an unbelievably difficult struggle for people. The thing that was most surprising to me, I think, in terms of my reaction to people, was how much I came to like a lot of the folks I refer to as my criminals. I was doing that research. I took a job working in a juvenile prison in Minnesota for a few months in order to get to know some juvenile felons and their families. A lot of those felons had been through a variety of difficult and traumatic experiences, and I wondered as I talked to them, I don't think crime is the way that I would have gone under any circumstances, but I thought, I wonder what my life would be like if I'd had their childhood instead of my childhood. And I kept thinking, but these people are criminals. And there was a point when I was talking to someone, he sort of said, oh, you know, give me your home address and we can correspond. And I thought, I don't know that I want to do that. You know, you have broken into people's houses and murdered them. Best perhaps if you don't break into mine. But I really found it very engaging. And I was left a lot of the time with a sense that the people who committed crimes were actually in the throes of some terrible compulsion that was foreign to me, but that was as real to them as my own unfortunate compulsion to bite my fingernails is to me, that it's just something that they kind of, it was their way of being in the world. And, you know, I felt like a lot of them had done things that I avoid doing, not because they're illegal, but because they are of no, they hold no attraction for me. I don't feel like if all the laws went away, I'd break into people's houses and murder them. It wouldn't occur to me. And I felt humbled by realizing how strong those compulsions were in them. Anyone else?
Yes, at the back.
Is there going to be a longer film?
I'm just in discussion with various people about making a longer film, and the trailer attracted a certain amount of notice, so I very much hope so. It's a long process, either a film or possibly a TV series that deals with the various conditions in the book.